You're listening to Scopes Monkey Choir. Music in a rational universe.
Scopes Monkey Choir, the podcast where music and sound meet science and skepticism. I'm Matthew.
I'm Hating.
And this is episode 68, and this one is, well, it's about a little bit more about art than science or skepticism, but...
It is, indeed. It's about monkeys on the beach.
Yeah.
No,
Einstein in the trees. As regular listeners will know, Hating is on tour right now with Einstein in the Beach, the Philip Glass / Robert Wilson opera. And she interviewed... Well, there you are. You should probably be saying this.
Yeah, sure. I interviewed Philip Glass, who you have actually known, or maybe he's known you since you were very small.
Well, sort of, yeah.
So I decided that since I got this gig with Einstein on the Beach and I had this podcast about science, that they were sort of related and I had access to this famous composer. So I thought I would talk to him about the science of Einstein. And so I did.
And this is going to be a two-parter. So this is the first part, episode 68. And anything else, or should we just dive right in?
Well, I want to thank John Walter, the documentarian who made most of this recording, because he's making a documentary about the science, about science and music. I'm not sure he even knows exactly what his documentary is going to be about yet, but he made this nice recording. So thanks to John.
Yeah, very nice. It actually, the recording starts out a little bit odd through no fault of his own, through my fault. So the sound's a little odd in the beginning, but it gets better quickly. So don't worry about it. And I guess we'll see you next week and introduce the second half. Is that what's happening?
Yeah.
Okay.
All right.
Enjoy.
It took us decades to get to that level. The piece was beyond us for a long while.
How old were you when you guys?
I wasn't
wrote
that
this
young,
piece?
But I think I was 37. Bob was 32. We weren't that young, but we had worked separately for a long time. It was our first time working together, and that was the point. That it was the engagement of the two modalities of theater. You know, movement and image and music. And instrumental and vocal music, those two things, and the other two things. They hadn't been together like that before. No one had done it like that. I mean, Peter Brook was great, and the Living Theater, and Grotowski, great theater people are all. But putting those two things together like that took a while.
Yeah, I heard you telling Ann Bogart, or maybe it was Robert telling Ann Bogart in the talk on Sunday about that process and how much more easily performers today just
yes,
throw themselves
of course
into it. But all of this you've said 1,000 times many people. And
no, not so, that much. We haven't talked about it in a long time because I haven't seen it in a while. We haven't seen it in
no
20
years. No one's seen it in a while.
No, we haven't seen it in 20 years.
Are you excited?
Yes. Yeah.
So am I.
Yeah. Good.
But the point of all this, or this
what, and what are
this,
we doing?
Blatant edit. Blatant edit.
So, is there any specific scientific inspiration
well,
that
first of all,
comes up to the top
we
of your mind?
We have to put in the context of what of who Einstein was.
Of course.
And that becomes really a point of departure for the piece. Him as a person and him as a personality, which of course is connected to his work. In 1945, 1946, he had suddenly become probably one of the best known people on the planet. For reasons which he probably wasn't happy about. Through the Hiroshima and Nagasaki, it had that suddenly the theory of relativity had come home and in a way that no one expected.
Especially since he didn't really have anything to do with the actual building of the bomb.
He did, but that was information that was suppressed for a long time. He was a consultant with the Navy. who was in charge of certain, the elements had been divided up, and there was a big problem, and he solved the problem.
Right. So, but
that's never talked about.
Right.
But I think we can talk about it now. he didn't want to be associated with it, and he didn't want to have anything to do with what he knew about. He didn't want anything to do with the Manhattan Project.
Of course not.
But, in fact, he was approached by the one of her from a very high source to that they needed him. There was a crisis going on. It was very possible that the war could be lost. And there was a big race. The Germans and the Americans were racing towards the bomb. And it wasn't clear who was going to get there. Remember, you can't remember this, you weren't even born yet. But there was the V-2 rockets, and there were these the first missiles that were being built. And had they had the right warhead, it would have been a different story. Could have been a whole very different history. The problem was the kind of uranium that was needed was an isotope, a variation of uranium, which is called heavy. It was a heavier one. It had an extra electron in it.
Neutron.
Thank you. God, you know your stuff. Good for you.
Just a little.
It had an extra one. And the question was how to isolate it. And what Einstein did, as I understand it, he suggested that there could be a screen that the uranium would be passed through, and that the heavier elements would not pass through the screen, and they would be isolated. And by doing that, they were able to develop the plutonium. Is that what we called it at that point? I'm not sure.
I'm not sure
a little
either.
Vague about this part of it. But at that point, they had the material that was needed, and what happened? People would come up from Washington, have very very secret private meetings with him, so he was involved with it. Now we didn't know that at the time. No one knew it for a long, long time. He didn't want it to be known, and he didn't want to have that. But there it is. That's not what I wanted to talk about. The point was is that. He had suddenly become probably the most famous scientist since the apple fell on Newton's head. Whether it fell on his head or not, we don't know. But the story is the falling apple on Newton. That was the famous story of science until that moment. Of course, then there was Galileo and the telescope. There were a few other things. There were some pretty good stories going around. But the idea that there was a man living in Princeton, this guy Albert Einstein, who had understood something called the theory of relativity, which according to what we were told at that time, and I remember I was 8 years old, but I remember this, that only 6 people in the world understood the theory. And somehow this...
I think that's up to 8 now.
No, it's up to about 8 million. No, it's like everything else. It's like everything, these big thresholds are there and then they're passed and then everyone jumps over together. You know, the same thing happened with the way we play the music now. I say we in a collective way. We had very great difficulty playing the music in 1976, and it's some of the same people are sitting there. John Gibson and Michael Reisman, I was there until recently. And then what happened is that we developed a performance technique which goes with the music, which didn't exist when I wrote it. You know, I was writing the music, there was no performance style or technique to go with it. That's always true. That was true for dodecaphonic music when it first came out. It was probably true for the romantic music of the late 19th century. There's always a gap between the idea of the music of that the composer comes up with and the way that you play it. And what happened is that now that gap is over. We're finished with that. And now people like yourself and other people can perform the work with a relative ease, I would say, compared to what it was. It was very difficult for us. We learned to do it, but now the younger people don't have to go through that process of, it's more available to them in some way. Now, getting back to Einstein, what was the point about Einstein? Was that for Bob and I, we were working with the idea of a story that wasn't a story. In other words, how do you tell a story on stage that is not a narrative story? Or to put it another way, how do you go from the beginning to the end of the piece without telling a story? And one of the ways was doing it was for Bob, and he was his suggestion. He said, well, we find somebody who we don't have to tell the story because everybody knows who he is.
Mm.
Since everybody knew who Einstein was, we didn't have to tell the story of Einstein. So that's why he's there. So basically, there were a number of other people that were candidates, but and Bob, during that time when he was working, was doing things of that kind. I did a piece after that, which was quite different, which was about Gandhi in South Africa, and no one knew that story.
Mm-hmm.
We thought we knew it, but we didn't know it. In this case, it was quite different, but we didn't make up a story of Einstein, but we made a sequence of themes and images. Now, how we can, how does this connect to Einstein? We spent a lot of time in the making of Einstein looking for Einstein. We could have called the piece Looking for Einstein,
mm-hmm.
because we were trying to find him. And Bob and I would say, is Einstein in this scene? And sometimes he wasn't, sometimes he wasn't. When he was, we could put him down, he could play the violin. We knew this one thing that we could always have him play the violin, and that would be our Einstein. And he sits in a very significant place on a kind of a platform in between the stage and the orchestra pit.
Mm-hmm.
So he splits the difference between being a stage person and being a music pit person by being there. The singers also go between the stage and the pit. Einstein stays rooted right in the middle like that. Often we said to us, where, and now the original title of the piece actually was Einstein on the Beach on Wall Street. That was the actual title.
Einstein on the Beach on Wall Street.
Yeah. Eventually we dropped Wall Street because it just seemed like a long title. I don't know when it got dropped. Bob doesn't remember either. At one point, that was originally, it's on a book of drawings that Bob gave me years ago. The title is there.
Mm-hmm.
At one point we simply called it Einstein on the Beach. And at one point, for example, Bob was worrying about it. He said, what the beach? What are we going to do about the beach? And then he said to Lucinda, could you write something about the beach?
Mm-hmm.
And that becomes
the air conditioning supermarket and
the air conditioned nightmare supermarket. And it's a short little thing. It's about, what, maybe five or sentences long. He says, and it ends with a word, I was wondering whether we could go to the beach, something like that.
Yes. No. So avoiding the beach, I think, is how it ends.
The beach gets in there. So,
yes.
But that was just part of the title. But apart from that, Bob was very interested in other aspects of Einstein. Now, I was, between the two of us, I was the one that was doing, I would do the book, I would read the books. Bob didn't like to read. And he said, just tell me about it. And I would read things. And I had been very interested in Einstein because I was 8 years old when Einstein became famous.
Mm.
Bob was three.
Mm-hmm.
So that moment was indelibly etched in my memory because it was such pictures of him. There was a very popular magazine called Life Magazine. You may have seen old copies of it. There was a big photocopy cover on it. He was on the cover. He was on everything. Everybody knew Einstein. Suddenly, we had a new superstar. For the first time, the superstar who wasn't a movie star. And we've had some since then, but he was a super duper star, and he was a scientist.
Now, how much of your interest in him when you were 8 years old was actually about the science?
It was about the science. What was going on in America at that time? Suddenly, there were people going around the country, going to libraries and schools, and giving talks on relativity, because no one knew what it was. And when we say that no one understood the theory, what people meant was that no one understood the mathematics.
I couldn't prove it. That might still be true.
Yeah, no, it's not true. A lot of people understand the mathematics now, but most of us don't understand it.
Right.
We don't know it. But
most artists don't understand.
But mathematicians and scientists and physicists, they routinely get that
mathematics.
But we don't know it. But the point. The point was that people were all over the country giving talks about relativity, and Einstein himself wrote a book about relativity, and he had a wonderful description of himself, which doesn't appear in this opera, by the way, because he tried to just, someone said to Mr. Einstein, where did you get the idea? And he said, I got the idea like this. This is what he said. He said, I imagine myself sitting on a beam of light, and the beam of light was racing through space at the speed of light. And I said to myself, what do I see? And what he had the vision. What he saw was everything rushing past him. In other words, he realized that he would be standing still, and everything was going the other way. And he saw that in a visionary way, which, by the way, is the way a lot of amazing scientific ideas start from. And that's an important point. That one of the things that appealed to me about Einstein always was that he was not just someone who did mathematics. In fact, he claims that he wasn't particularly good at mathematics, that he had to create a mathematics to describe what he saw. Mm-hmm. In other words, he started from a perceptual phenomena, a personal vision of how the world looks like, what the world looks like. And then he had to find a mathematics to describe it. And that became the theory of relativity. Now, so what you have now, this is the point. People were going around the country, and I was living in a little town, not a little, Baltimore, Maryland. We had a big library system, and I was very young, I was 8, 9, and 10, and I would go to these lectures and since they were designed for laymen, a kind of a precocious 8 or 9 year old could easily understand it, because it was written. These descriptions were written for that level of mental ability, and I had it. These were the ways it was described. So the ideas of Einstein were widely circulated. And I knew them, and I personally got very interested in astronomy. At about that age, I joined an astronomy club. I was making a telescope. I was doing all this. I wasn't particularly good at science. I was better at music. Fortunately, I had a day job, which was music. But my idea of a night job being science didn't work out. Even at the university, I was doing mathematics, and I made a pass at it, but I understood very quickly that I was not a gifted mathematician. I had a chance at music. I didn't have much of a chance at science. But I went through an exercise of imagining what would life be like as a scientist, and I just wasn't cut out for it. But I would say that what happened as a result of that, I've written 3 operas about scientists since then. One was Einstein, the one was about Galileo. I did the music, I did an opera about Kepler. And I've also done the music for a film about Stephen Hawking. So that I've become the scientist composer. I think I got that one pretty well covered.
And a lot of people see the way you write music as scientific or mathematical.
Well, okay, now that's actually true. But at the time when I was working that way, it wasn't true. And the reason it's true now is because we talked about this the other day, you might remember. I was beginning to work with rhythm as a binary language. Now, I had learned that because I was studying with Ala Raka and I worked with Ravi Shankar, and I knew something about the way Asian music, and specifically Indian music, was organized. And I understood that that the tala, the rhythmic cycles of Indian music, could be broken down and were broken down into twos and threes. So 16 could be 3 plus 3 plus 2 plus 2 plus 3 plus 3. It could be 4 plus 4 plus 4. It could be 3 plus 3 plus 3 plus 2 plus 2. So there are all these different ways that you could do it. 3 plus 3 plus 3 plus 3, 2 plus 2. So all those ways you can go up to add up to 16. So basically, I saw that Indian music was organized. I didn't use the word binary, but it was done as threes and twos. The binary language of the computer world is ones and zeros, but it's basically the same. It's either one or zero or two or three. It's one or the other. So basically, you have a language built out of two elements. In that way, it turned out. But you have to understand that in 1968 and 69, when I was working on these, 67 actually, I began working with Ravi Shankar in 65. So it really goes back that far. When I was beginning to work that way, there was no digital language. There were no computers. There was nothing like that around. People were writing mathematical music, but by that they meant 12-tone music. They would count. I mean, from my point of view, that was completely idiotic. I mean, numbers 1 through 12, and I mean...
arbitrarily.
I mean, and then you just did different arrangements of it. Not nearly as interesting as endless series of twos and threes that could form into patterns. You know, to me, the theory of atonality was for simpletons. Whereas the a binary language of twos and threes was endlessly interesting. So it turned out that I was working with the multimodal language, but at the time when I was doing it, it was common in Indian music and even in African music to a degree for a different reason. But it would be in a non-Western music generally, it could be found, but it could not be found in Western music. And I was emphatically living in the West. I was in Paris, I was in New York, I wasn't living in New Delhi, though I did go there. And I've been traveled around a lot and did that, all that. But the point, getting back to the discussions of what happened, we got very interested, and I say we, the collective we who were the laymen, laywomen who were interested in what was this whole new idea about the world was made, about the speed of light, about movement in space. I mean, this is the first thing since Newton that this was a huge, huge deal. No one had defined, and in fact, it turned out that a lot of mathematics of Newton still was workable. It was workable as long as you didn't get into sizes that were too big or too small. If they got too big, then it didn't work in cosmology. It didn't work in the microcosm, it didn't work in the macrocosm. Just, it kind of worked with balls rolling down inclined planes and trajectories of let's say, cannonballs and how they hit, you know, how they fall and things like that. Things that people would be interested in. I mean, scientists, military people are always interested in science for
practical reasons.
Yeah, exactly. In fact, a lot of the science that was developed in the 20th century, let alone the 21st century, was developed for military purposes. Mm-hmm. The internet was developed as an alternate telephone system. In case our telephone system got knocked out, we would have this other system called which we didn't even call it the internet, but that's what it was. Mm-hmm. So that was a byproduct of a military strategy. So that's what that was. Now, this is, I knew a lot about that. Bob was 5 years younger than me. He knew about it, but he was a little bit younger, and I think he probably didn't get involved in it as I was. But it was Bob's suggestion that he said, let's do Einstein. I said, we can do that, let's do that. And because I had a lot of history with it. And he said, tell me what it's about. So Bob and I began talking about it, and I read more books about it, and we went over the ideas and, you know, we just were looking at the dance, the field dance, with the little, we call them donuts, but they're supposed to be flying saucers, you know. So we were into that. And
does the title field dance also refer to field theory at all? Or
no, not really. It meant things that happen in a field, in an open space. It was much simpler than that.
I remember telling Ann Bogart that lots of people would come and lay interpretations on top of those abstractions.
No. Well, we were, apart from, I may have sound, as I was talking to you, you may have gotten the idea that I knew a lot about this. Actually, I don't. I have a slightly... better, I have a, let's say, an amateur layman's knowledge of physics, but not a physicist's knowledge of physics. Someone who likes physics, and I read books like, I read the Brian Greene books, and I read, you know, all these books about, you know, about string theory and alternate universes, and I read all this stuff, and pretty much can follow it. But when it gets into the footnotes, I skip the footnotes. So, but still, for the purposes of theater, we were, it was not a problem for us to take ideas and to present them in a theatrical way. So the trains, where is the train? Well, when Einstein described that very often, and this happened to everybody who took trains, and you'd be sitting at a train station, and you see a train moving, and you thought, the train was coming to the station. Actually, you were leaving the station. This happened all the time. So we knew about trains, and we knew about trains passing, and we knew about sounds, the Doppler effect, and all this stuff that we knew, the way that happened, the way that when trains are moving away, how the sound is moving away faster with the train, and so the sound of the whistle sounds different. So trains were a big deal.